Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
It is the Savage Nation, where we have a retro president who was really not so much like the ship captain who smashed the ship on the rocks, which has been picked up from me by the Republican National Committee chairman, who was attacked for that by Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who did not like comparing the president to the Italian ship captain. No, that's not really severe enough to compare Obama to him. You have to compare Obama to, well, shall I say, Lenin, to truly get an understanding of what this man is trying to do to this country. There's an article from England where it says Barack Obama is trying to make the U.S. a more socialist state. That's baby talk already. We know that. But here they're writing in England that it used to be that the U.S. led the rest of the world and England tried to catch up with them and follow them. Said America led the fashion world and we tagged behind. Well, so much for that. Barack Obama is now putting the United States squarely a decade behind Britain. Listening to the president's State of the Union message last week was like a surreal visit to our own recent past, she writes. They were almost word for word all those interminable Gordon Brown budgets that preached fairness while listing endless new ways in which central government would intervene in every form of economic activity. Later in a television interview, Obama described his program of using higher taxes on the wealthy to bankroll new government spending as a recipe for a fair, sound approach to deficit reduction and rebuilding the country, to which we who come from the future can only shout, no, go back, don't come down this road. And she's warning us about what happened in England, which they're still trying to extricate themselves from, of stealing wealth from the producers, and how the word fairness sounds so good, but it's not really fair, and how there's a big difference between fairness and stealing things from people, and how taking money from those who earn it and give it to those who do nothing will only destroy the economy, not create it. But you've heard all of that. So I'm going to go past that to something else. You know what that something else is? Here's my headline. No luck for luck. Ratso Rizzo returns to HBO 40 years later. And that is in a reference to HBO's new drama, Luck, about horse racing, starring, of all people, the has-been, Dustin Hoffman, and the, I don't know how to characterize him as, I even forgot his name. Who's the other actor in it? I forgot his name. Used to be great, then he got drunk, was found wandering on the highways of Washington. Nick Nolte, who plays himself, apparently, because he's incoherent and looks like an old drunk. I was shocked. I mean, I like television. I admit it. It's one of my greatest relaxations. And most of you don't have HBO. I understand that. But I watch it, so I report. Remember, my show is News, Views, and Reviews. It's a little different than some. It's not straight political, you know. So I turned it on because I've liked Ratso Rizzo ever since he did Ratso Rizzo. In fact, when he did the thing with the kid, the young guy with the older woman, whatever that was, I forgot the movie. But I've watched Ratso Rizzo over the years, and I didn't think he did very many movies since then that were any good. And now we're supposed to believe this is the greatest thing in the world with Dustin Hoffman, with a creator with a great track record, David Milch, who created NYPD Blue and created Deadwood, and Michael Mann of Miami Vice and Heat and Collateral. So, you know, you turn it on, you figure it's going to be something good. It was so bad, I couldn't follow the script. I didn't know what they were talking about. But the worst part of it is the character played by Ratso Rizzo, Dustin Hoffman. He's supposed to be a beloved noble gangster. There are no such thing as a noble gangster. That's number one. That's like the noble savage myth that was put out by anthropologists. There may be some primitives who are noble, but there's no such thing as a noble savage per se. And there may be some gangsters who have some nobility, but the word gangster means you're not noble. It means you're stealing people's earnings. So there's Dustin Hoffman, which is beyond me. Did anyone see this, by the way? I really would like to hear from any... First, let's start with the... Are there any listeners to the Savage Nation who spend the money to subscribe to HBO? That's number one. Now, I would say if I'm in an audience of 1,000 people, five hands would go up. Most, five hands, 0.5%. So if you have HBO and if you watch this, do you agree with me that this is one of the worst series you've ever seen in your life? So why am I talking about it? Because it's beautiful to see this, in a sense, to see such a hype for a character like Dustin Hoffman, and to see the buildup where they say, he said he doesn't do television, but he was convinced he had to do it. It was so good. And there's Nick Nolte, who's going to win an Academy Award. I don't have any idea what this is all about. So it brings up another series of questions. And the reason I'm bringing it up is this, which is, do you think Hollywood is broken because 60s hippies like Dustin Hoffman still run the show with their warped, childish, communistic attitudes? Does that explain why Hollywood is so anti-American? Why do you think Hollywood is so anti-family? And why do so many actors of a certain ethnic background continuously try to be wise guys? Why is Dustin Hoffman continuously trying to portray a wise guy when, with his narrow shoulders and beak nose, he's comedic in this role? I don't understand how he can get away with this. Who are they doing these movies for? Who's doing these? Who watches this and says, this is great? Oh, man, was that good. Now you say, well, what does it have to do with politics? Well, everything and nothing. The very same childish fools who make fortunes pretending to be gangsters or such other things are the ones who sort of told us Obama was the Messiah. You don't know this, but it was Hollywood who first picked Obama. It was Hollywood who first raised the most amount of money for Obama way back when. And it was Hollywood who pushed Obama. You don't know this, but they're the most powerful people in America. The Hollywood mob is the most powerful mob the world has ever seen, greatly, greatly, greatly distancing the actual overt criminals that we hear so much about. And so you have impressive bloodlines in the form of these actors and directors and writers. But from the beginning of the series about a racetrack, the show stalls right out of the gates as though the horses dumped on themselves and slipped in the mare. I couldn't understand what they were doing. I had no idea what in the world was in this. I think it's going to be the season's biggest letdown. Am I alone? Now, the series begins with Chester Ace Bernstein, played by Hoffman, who just got out of federal prison in the care of his driver, Gus, Dennis Farina. Now, that becomes even more comedic as this goes on. Ace has taken the fall for some of his colleagues, and he went away for 3 years, and he's setting up a scheme where he's going to get a horse, is going to win money, and I couldn't understand what they were talking about. Arcane dialogue. Scruffy characters that don't convince of us anything. In fact, one of the reviewers in Sioux Falls wrote a beautiful line. It says, with luck, Milch displays an almost abusive disregard for viewers who are new to this world. I love that line. Abusive disregard for viewers who are new to this world. That's like Obama in the White House. Obama has an almost abusive disregard for voters who don't even know what he's talking about. Characters pop up on the screen with little or no context, often uttering muddled and indecipherable bits of dialogue. And then they conclude, imagine The Sopranos with a pilot episode in which you never really get to know Tony Soprano. Well, that's exactly what it is. But I have a couple of questions, which I've already asked. And I'm not going to ask them. Oh, we saw people who saw it. 2 people out of 10,000 are calling today about it. Eric in Sacramento, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Dr. Savage. I couldn't follow the show. I didn't get it.
I have a PhD, and I didn't know what they were talking about.
It was insanity.
Who were they talking about? Horse racing, mumbling to each other. How could this get produced?
I don't get it. But I just don't get it.
Did you watch it with anticipation because Dustin Hoffman and Nick Nolte were in it?
I don't care for Dustin Hoffman, but I just watched it because there was a little bit of hype on it.
Okay. Same here. Same here. Didn't you find it comedic that a guy is kind of, I don't know how to put it, with the nose and the little shoulders would play a tough guy? I'm sorry. I don't know. How else do I put it? Why the cat? You know, Dustin Hoffman, by the way, has always wanted to be a wise guy, so to speak. You know that he's done this before, and he's done it in a laughable way. Here he comes back again. This is his whole dream in Hollywood, is to act like he's a gangster. I don't understand why he does this. He made a fortune being a fairly good actor 40 years ago, and he never matched what he did in Goodbye Columbus. Although I would say in Ratso Rizzo, he approached his inner self. He channeled his inner self. I mean, this guy grew up in Hollywood. We know that. Dustin Hoffman was born in Hollywood. He dropped out of Santa Monica High School, College, never completed a degree, which, again, there's nothing wrong with that. Most of the idiots I know couldn't get through a college. And he's not, but he made a fortune. Now he wants to be a gangster? I don't get this. I just don't get this. And it goes to the biggest story of Hollywood and politics. Hollywood and politics. Horse drama needs luck to survive on HBO. I would say the Democrat drama needs luck to survive in America, because virtually everyone is on to Obama, including the Democrats in Florida. I mean, if you've got the Cubans and the Jewish people in Florida already turning on the Democrat Party, which they've done, it doesn't get any worse than that. Even the Washington Post shockingly today reported the following, and this is their headline, not mine. I have to read it to you exactly. I think they must be listening to my show, because they said Obama is the most polarizing president ever. That's right. That's the Washington Post, the liberal newspaper. Where is it? Obama, the most polarizing president ever, in the Washington Post. He ran and won in 2008 on the idea of uniting the country, yet he's divided it. So there it is. Then you have this creature from the Black Lagoon comparing Obama to the cruise captain. She says, compare Obama to the cruise captain by the Republicans as incendiary. She's got a fishmonger's mouth on her, that Debbie Wasserman Schultz, that the word incendiary doesn't even come near this woman's tone, delivery, and activities. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Would you believe I got 10 callers already? On this, I'm going to deal with this, because you see how I'm going from the failed HBO series Luck to Obama and politics, and tying it into Obama trying to make the USA a more Soviet state by the day. Oh, by the way, I've come up with a subtitle for my new book. We were toying with it for a few weeks. Trickled. It's not even listed. You can't buy it, so don't accuse me of pushing a book. Trickle Down Tyranny will be out in April, so I shouldn't even talk about it. It's too far ahead. I'll be right back.
Savage.
A man gets out of jail 3 years, maybe takes a trip to some island somewhere. You'll get out a month. Buy a piece of my racetrack.
I admit I'm halfway nervous.
You think you're the first front in history?
I think, Mr. Bernstein, something personal is going on here.
All right, fine. We got the dramatic music. It was horrible. We're talking about a show it's got to be the biggest flop in history. Luck, with Ratso Rizzo returning on HBO 40 years later playing a gangster. It would be laughable if you could decipher what they were mumbling about. See, I guess what I'm getting at, and I figure I'm going to figure it out during the show, you'll help me, is how does a thing like this get produced on HBO? Here's a network that does some interesting things and then a lot of dreck. They have fake comedians on who debase their own race or their own ethnicity. That's considered comedy today. They never, ever present even a modicum of a centrist or conservative view. And they all talk to each other. So this garbage gets produced with Dustin Hoffman. Now, you talk about a problem with women. There's some women in there. I don't even know what they're doing in it. Here's some kind of skinny Irish skank who's an exercise girl standing on the side of the track. I don't even know what she's doing in the plot. All she does is talk with her brogue. And she has like a pimple. She stands there with a pimple on the side of the track. and speaks with a kind of Irish brogan. That's, no one knows what she's doing in it. Does anyone know what I'm talking about and why I'm talking about this? New York Michael on WOR, help me with this. What did you think of this movie Luck, this series Luck on HBO?
I signed up for it with 10 minutes to airtime, and I felt it was pompous and cryptic. It was like a Jackson Pollock painting. You know,
oh, my, you mean you subscribed to HBO just because Hoffman and Nolte were in it?
Yeah, I just got back from the Philippines, and I wanted to treat myself to...
No, this is interesting. I remember I signed up for HBO because of The Sopranos. And then I've been so fed up with them on and off and on and off, you know, over the years. I didn't like Boardwalk Empire in the beginning. Then it grew on me. You know, it was a little rigid. But at least that had a craft to it. This didn't seem to have any craft to it. Am I wrong?
No, it was messy. They threw a lot of little... It was an appetizer for people who have been to the racetrack. And they had big I had big expectations. And
Are you a guy who goes to the track?
Well, actually, if you want to know the truth, I'm looking for a stable woman.
That's interesting. A stable woman. That's very funny because you threw the word stable in.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't.
You threw me off. I didn't know what you were saying. You're looking for a woman in a stable or a stable with a woman in it?
No, I'm joking. No, I don't go to the track much. I did a few times.
The only thing I thought of was when they killed the horse, when he broke his leg, the leg snapped. And then they injected the horse and killed him, because we covered that 2-3 years ago on the Savage Nation of how criminal the racing industry has become with what they do to the thoroughbreds. That's a story unto itself, Michael, how they push these poor animals beyond their limits and basically kill them. And why they have to kill a horse after he breaks his leg, I still don't understand.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you remember that movie years ago, they shoot horses, don't they? I mean, thank God when a dog breaks his leg, they can run around on three legs. You know, Teddy, I never pushed Teddy. Today we walked up and down a hill, a steep hill. You could die from it. I figured if someone found me conked on the side of the road, they would know that I just conked out. What a hill. Teddy didn't break his leg. We did fine.
Savage.
Gals that want to buy it, most of them are old and dignified. Social register types, you know what I mean? They can't be trotting down at Times Square to pick out the merchandise. They gotta have some kind of middleman. And that's where old Daniel comes in, you know what I mean?
I'm walking here!
That was the apogee of Dustin Hoffman's career when he said, "I'm walking here as Ratso Rizzo." And it's been downhill ever since. So now they come with this series. What I loved about the build-up to this Luck thing was they said, we went to Dustin Hoffman and we know he never does TV. He never does TV. He's probably clamoring over himself to get a role. Oh, no, I'm too good for TV. I'm a movie star. Jumped at the opportunity. I wouldn't mind it, but it was awful. That's why I said no luck for Luck. Ratso Rizzo returns to HBO 40 years later. But what does it tell us? What's the biggest story? That Hollywood has so disconnected itself from reality that old hippies are still running the entire show with their warped, childish, communistic, socialist attitudes. They don't even understand America, which is why they're so locked into the rhetoric of the 1930s. You know, of the common man, let's walk with the common man, let's be in solidarity with the common man. You know, that kind of stuff that we've all heard about. It's tiresome. And we're stuck with a political system that's bound up with this tiresome mentality is what it comes down to. And so it is worth talking about entertainment, who runs the entertainment industry, this horse drama a Luck, run by these old aging hippies from Hollywood. And you ask yourself, how much longer can this go on until they grow up and understand the damage they're doing and continue to do? Look, I could talk about Newt Gingrich. Oh, there goes the meter. There goes the meter just up a jump. I could talk about Newt Gingrich, or I could talk about Mitt Romney. See, now, if I had a meter that was reading listener response, all I got to do is say, Romney, Gingrich, Paul, Santorum. But I can't do it anymore. You know, I'll do it tomorrow. Tomorrow's the primary in Florida, and we have to see what happens over there. It probably starts to, you know, already getting what bothers me is that they have already primary returns already in Florida with the absentee ballots. The country has been turned into a joke. The entire voting system is a lockdown joke. You've got illegal aliens who are voting as citizens. That's A. Beyond belief. Then you have a polling computer data service that's headquartered in Spain, owned by nobody knows who. They actually, all data runs through this computerized service in Spain. Does George Soros own it? Does he own it? We don't know. The whole thing's crazy. Then you got absentee balloting. I haven't any idea why I even vote anymore. By the time I get to the poll, I feel the election's over. It's been determined somewhere in a bookie joint. It looks like this thing luck about the horse race. The people who fixed the races fixed the election. That's all. So if anybody wants to talk about it, that's good. I was actually thinking after watching, the one thing I didn't like was the horse being given a needle because he broke his leg. But that happens because of the evils of the whole system, that they push the animals beyond their abilities to run. And then when they snap a leg, they execute them on the track. It's beyond belief that they're allowed to do that. That's number one. Then number two, it reminds us of our own lives. Many of us feel that we're being driven around a track at too fast a pace and that we're dropping like flies. In America, we work far too hard, especially since about 50% of the adult population doesn't contribute anything to society. They do nothing except vote Democrat and give me more. You know what I'm saying? Many of us feel like we're running around a track, you know, that it's endless. Like what's the animal in the circular thing? The guinea pig? When it runs around in the thing? And I don't know, guinea pigs run anymore? I don't have guinea pigs. Hamster. I once had a hamster. It had no name. I can't get into rodents. Sometimes I meet like weird people tell me they keep rats. There's something, I'm sorry. I never heard of people like this in my day. A dog, a cat, a parakeet. Then you're already descending into the reptile keepers. I understand that. Then you got into the stage where a rat became a pet. I never heard of anything like this. It's like a crazed world. The rat brought plague to the world, and the Black Death almost wiped out the 2/3 of humanity. Or was it 1/3? And now they're keeping them in a house, giving them names and talking to them, like Lenny. Like Lenny in a novel. So I don't know what accounts for people's taste anymore. And that's why we come right back again to Ratso Rizzo in this HBO drama. Maybe you liked it. I didn't. I couldn't understand it. I did not understand it at all. I try to listen to it. Look, I write novels. My last one was a 6 weeks bestseller in New York Times. I'm working on my second one. I try to make sure people can follow the dialogue and follow the plot. It's wonderful to be so intellectually ahead of everybody that no one understands you. I understand that. That's a great way to show what a genius you are, is to make it so obscure no one understands what you're doing. And then you could claim that the average person is such a moron, he didn't get what you were doing. I get that. I try to avoid that. Anyone could write in. I met many of these artists in the cafes over the years. They sit with the hate faces and a little pen and a book. We know them. We all have them in our family, or we know someone who knows someone. And most of them have never been an artist, and they don't even know what art is. And that's why I say Hollywood is so disconnected that I figure I will have a few more minutes on this and then move on, okay? Tucson, Arizona. Sharon, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Dr. Savage. I'm a fan.
Thank you.
I completely agree with you that the show was awful. I am a horse racing fan. My husband is a very avid horse racing fan. He graduated from the racetrack industry program in Tucson, where you basically get a degree in horse racing. So we know a lot about the horse racing business.
There's a degree in horse racing?
There's a degree in horse racing, and some of the students go, they can become a racetrack official, manage a racetrack, and then there
That's astounding. I never heard of any. I mean, it's a big industry, obviously. The guys I knew who were into it were degenerate gamblers. I didn't know there was an industry tied to a college degree.
Yes. There's usually about 40 to 45 students in that program, and the students come from all over the United States. And
What kind of person becomes a vet? What kind of person would become a vet who specializes in euthanizing horses that break their legs?
That is very sad.
It's like Dr. Mengele, you know what I mean? She comes out with a big needle. It'll look like a stunt needle. The horse snapped, and then bingo, and then you see the light go out of the horse's eye. It was the only part of the whole show that I empathized with. I thought it was horrendous. By the way, we did this show once years ago, Sharon, with callers on the new breed of racehorse owner and how greedy they are. Isn't it true that they push these horses beyond their limits?
I believe there are occasions that that happens. I have very mixed emotions about horse racing.
They're like kids from Great Neck who were told they have to go to Harvard. You know, they all end up with nervous breakdowns living in the village. You know, like, you're going to go to Harvard when the kids doesn't know what Harvard is. Like, that's some guarantee to become something. I have met more Harvard graduates who have amounted to nothing in my life than I could count them both. At least 10 of them. Oh, I went to Harvard. They walk around like they have an entitlement because they went to Harvard. Most of them either go in their father's business or wind up doing nothing with their lives. The people I happen to know who've achieved something either went to a city college or didn't go to college at all. The ones I know actually built something big, either they went to a crappy community college or a city college or a state college and partied for four straight years, or they didn't go to college at all, if you want to term in terms of human success. I'm talking financial success. So, you know, doesn't mean I, by the way, I'm a big believer in higher education. I want to clarify that. I don't want to sound like I'm an anti-elitist. I've spent many years in higher education. Bachelor's from Queens College in science, worked harder for that than any other degree in my life. Master's degree, then another master's degree, really high-end master's degrees, not in a crackerjack box. Then a PhD from the University of California at Berkeley. I really lived it and I ate it. Would I do it again? I don't think so. But the point is, you cannot compare the exposure of the human mind to that level of education to anything else. Which, again, I have to say, without stepping on some toes here, that unfortunately too much of Hollywood consists of high school dropouts. And they assume that their wealth equals knowledge, or they assume that their wealth equals, that their wealth equals wisdom. They're very different. And unless you've been exposed to the great books, unless you've read the great books, unless you've had time to be exposed to some great teachers, and amongst some of the professors are some phenomenal minds, you're not a fully developed mind. And that's the problem with so much of America today, is the lack of education at a higher level, higher education. So I'm a real believer in it. It depends on what you do, where you go, what you believe in, how hard you work on it. So that's it. So I told you, if we talked about Hollywood, it would get back to this. Michael in Washington, D.C., thanks for listening. You're on the Savage Nation.
Hi, Dr. Savage. I'm a freshman in college. I just started listening to your show at the beginning of last semester. And I just wanted to say thank you for all you've taught me. You put what I want to say into words. And the university I go to is very liberal, so I'm constantly exposed to the left side of things.
Well, there's no such thing as a non-liberal university. It's the swamp where people who can't do anything else wind up going to work.
I would have to agree.
Unfortunately, it's now the swamp that attracts the creatures who can't survive in an industry. They get poor kids like yourself who have to listen to them, and if you don't regurgitate what they tell you to think, they give you an F or a D. So thanks for listening to the greatest university on air, the Savage Nation. What about Nick Nolte? Let's go past Dustin Hoffman if you saw it. Nick Nolte was once stone actor, great. Remember some of his movies? The one where he played with a father who beat him? I forget. That was a great movie. He kills him in the end with a shotgun. I love that movie. That was so primal. That was so Abraham and Isaac. You know what I'm saying? He's a great actor. But then he went off the rails. Now all of a sudden, starting about 2 months ago, I see that they start showing Nick Nolte everywhere. They do an HBO series on his life. Then they do this. Then he's going to win an Academy Award. Little did I know, they were setting it up so we'd watch this series. I didn't know what he was talking about in this show. He sits mumbling with gray hair in old clothing. Mumbling, I didn't know what he was doing in this show. You know what I'm saying? So, Delaware, Patricia, welcome to the program.
Oh, Dr. Savage, it's a pleasure to hear an authentic person on the air. Hollywood does not encourage marriage. They don't place value on it. And family is where spiritual development is encouraged, character is developed, values are instilled, And good parenting requires both the involvement of a mother and father, in most cases, that each contributes. And this
this is why Hollywood is opposed to family, because they stand for the opposite of everything you just said. You know what's interesting, Patricia? The Golden Globes Awards occurred a few weeks ago, remember? I don't know if you watched them. Virtually every person who came to the stage said they thanked their mother, their father, their son, or their daughter. They were told to suddenly act like they care about family. Did you notice that?
I didn't see it.
You see, this is why I'm a cultural phenomenon, because I go from the high to the low, and I watch things, and I see things. That's the whole story. And here's someone who's going to catch me at a weak point, and I don't care. Jack, welcome to the Savage Nation. You're on the, where is he, line five? I can't even see. There it is. Jack from Albany, New York. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Mike, I'm sorry to do this to you, but I have to remind you of two words, Boardwalk Empire.
You're absolutely right, and if I were a guy trying to hide, I wouldn't have taken your call because it said you were going to say that. The fact of the matter is, I didn't like Boardwalk Empire in the beginning. I thought that, what's his name, who played the lead in that? Buscemi. I thought he looked too weak for the role of a gang leader, a guy who ran such an enterprise. But then I looked at the newspaper clippings from that era in Atlantic City. Apparently, he was almost a dead ringer for the guy.
Here's the problem, though. You convinced me, and you ruined the show for me. I hated it, and then I hear you 2 weeks later praising it, saying you were wrong about it.
I must have gotten up on the wrong side of bed the first few weeks. Or I don't know what it was, but did you watch Boardwalk Empire afterwards?
I couldn't. No, you convinced me so much that...
Well, I'm so sorry that I'm hurting HBO's sales today. You know how much I love the... Hollywood moguls. You know what I think of them. They're such wonderful people, and they've done so much for the character of the children in America, and they do so much for the advancement of civilization. So pardon me if I'm stepping on some toes here. I'll be right back.
Savage.
I'm talking here. This is the Savage Nation. The phone number, the website. It's a Monday. Lighten up. Tomorrow's the primary already. We know Obama's a Leninist. We know he's an out-of-control spender. We know he's an out-of-control hustler. We know that he's an out-of-control divider, not a uniter. We know it. We know all this already. So it's a Monday. I'm allowed to talk about something else once in a while. So I'm talking about Hollywood now, a term I don't think I have heard anywhere else. I'm sure someone will say they invented it. But okay, so I used Hollywood. Hollywood, California. I happen to love Hollywood. I go down there quite often, not to the movie people. I have, a relative who lives in Hollywood. And I'm one of the people who loves L.A., don't get me wrong. In fact, I prefer L.A. to San Francisco. I love the weather in San Francisco. I love the architecture in San Francisco. The people, unfortunately, is like a neutron bomb hit the city. A neutron bomb of liberalism took out all of the conservatives. The only thing remaining are the skeletons of Marx running around in a beautiful environment. Except where I go. Like tonight, I'll go to the North Beach restaurant probably. I'm friends with Lorenzo again. That's on again. He's back. He was away for 10 days. I missed him. To me, every relationship is very personal. There's not a... no such thing. I know people could say a relationship's not personal with someone. Every relationship, even where I eat, is very personal. In fact, especially where I eat, it's personal. If I don't like the owner doesn't like me, I'm afraid to eat the food. Why should I go to a place? So, we're friends again. I missed the guy. Now I'm going to go in again. I can't wait to hear his tales of Texas. He visited Texas. There's something I want to do with wine, by the way. Him and I, I'm talking about wine. I may actually go into the wine. Would you believe the wine business I'm thinking of it? So I have an on-again, off-again thing with wine. I can't find what I like. That when I do, it's very obscure. So I want to... I'll tell you about this another time. I was with him in 94, Lorenzo, when he cut his acreage up. He bought a big place of land up in Sonoma. I drove up in my old Caddy. 90, what, a 65 Caddy in the year 94. I'm crossing the dates. And I spent a day up there. This guy cleared the land himself with some workers, but he worked alongside them. He's been like an ox, this guy, like from the old universe. You talk about hard work. You compare it to what Obama wants for this country of roll. You're supposed to roll over and die if things happen to you. Someone looks at you the wrong way. You're supposed to get a napkin and stay home with your mother the rest of your life. If I ever told you the things this guy went through and where he is today and how he doesn't stop working in his age, you'd be very proud to know that you know a man like that. In many ways, I'm like him as well. There's certain impediments that have stood and do stand in my way, which can make another man crack. But here I am. I'm doing a daily radio show. I'm writing two books now. Maybe a third one is coming out. Why? Because this is the way it is. What are you on earth for? You know, every time you see a Hollywood star, like who was the one last week who said she's going into rehab because she used too many drugs and she partied too much? I'm supposed to have sympathy for that? Are you kidding me? Because some, you know what, in Hollywood, cracked up from too much drugs, too much sex, too much partying. I'm supposed to have sympathy, or every time another Hollywood cretin goes into rehab, that's a story. I'm supposed to have sympathy for them. I have no sympathy for them. Tell me about the tens of millions of Americans, like those who listen to my show, who don't go into rehab, who have control of themselves, who don't whine to everybody about something that stands in their way. Tell me the last time you saw a TV show on HBO about the nobility of a military family, who for generations they've sacrificed themselves and sometimes their lives or the lives of their ancestors were sacrificed so that we could have freedom in this country. Tell me the last time the Rats of Hollywood did a movie about the true men of Hollywood instead of some whining weasel who cracked up in Afghanistan because he couldn't take it anymore. Every movie that's come out about the war is about some American soldier who was too weak to go on. When have you last seen one about a soldier who does go on despite all odds? Tell me the last time. And that's why it's worth talking about Ratso Rizzo, HBO, and Hollywood. You understand the connections here? I'm glad you do. Thank you for listening.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Going to play when I change my mind? Alan West. No, he'll be on at 4:30. He could tell us how he said that Obama and Reid and Pelosi should leave the country. They've already left the country, just as Hollywood has left the country. We were talking the last hour about this failed HBO episode series called Luck, with Ratso Rizzo returning 40 years later playing some kind of gangster. It's unbelievable to me how they produce this stuff. With women hanging around a racetrack, you don't even know what they have to do with the plot, talking in an Irish brogue, like a skanky girl with a mole. How does this get produced, I ask myself. And then we're talking about the Super Bowl, which I don't even know when it is. I know it's coming up, allegedly. I think, isn't it this weekend, Beowulf, truthfully? I know it's somewhat un-American to not know when the Super Bowl is next Sunday. In the past, the Radical Femmes used to do a thing on how on Super Bowl Sunday, women were beaten up over potato chips and beer. It turned out to be a complete lie. They made it up. Now they're saying pets get hurt and killed by white males and others on Super Bowl Sunday. I don't understand that. Why, you watch a ball game and you kill your pet? Does that include rats and crickets? Or how could they make these things up? Who listens to them? Let's go to the callers on the Savage Nation. At the bottom of the hour, we have the inimitable Congressman Alan West, a man I really admire, on the Savage Nation. Here we have the most incompetent administration in American history, the most divisive, getting away with it. It's astounding. Here's Hillary Clinton running around the world boasting about the Arab Spring when it blew up in her face, and they're talking about the Arab Spring with a straight face. The country's in flames. Egypt's kidnapping American diplomats. Islamists are taking over the whole Arab Crescent. And there she is running around the Middle East about her success with the Arab Spring. Beyond belief. New York, WOR Mike, welcome to the program. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Michael. A big fan. Just have to say I disagree with you on your interpretation of luck. I'm from a racing family, the Great Russ in Beaumont. I think you're from Belrose.
Oh, yeah.
If I'm not mistaken. At one point, you're from Brooklyn, Queens, and then Belrose. And so you know Belmont.
Absolutely. But the thing, no, here's the thing. If you're in the industry, maybe it made sense. But to a guy like me, I didn't even understand what they were talking about.
It's difficult. It's difficult for outsiders that don't know horse racing because it's very complicated, all the plot lines, all the characters.
Yes, that's what I'm getting at. It was too complicated. I'm a guy who likes drama, but I couldn't follow it.
I thought one of the most powerful things is the one you brought up with the female vet coming on the track and putting the horse down. That was very powerful to me, just because it was.
Yeah, when she brings out the big mock injection and executes him on the track.
That's very brutal. I had a friend that trained a horse, Gopher Juan. That was a good friend of mine, Billy Badgett. And he died right in front of him. It was a really tragic scene. A champion filly.
Why do they kill horses when they break their leg? You're in the racing industry, Mike. Why do they have to execute them?
Because they can't. All the bones and the power of the weight, they would just flail about and they would just kill themselves anyway. They're not.
You mean they? Okay, here's a stupid question from like Mickey Mouse Land. You mean they cannot build a prosthetic leg for a horse?
I think the funny thing is it's a class world. So if you have a high $5 million horse, they will do everything they can to get him to the surgery room and try to put a cast on it. They did that with Barbaro a few years ago, the horse that won the Kentucky Derby, and it
right.
worked because he got some kind of a foot disease in the hoof. And so
is it because of insurance? In other words, they have to execute him. They say the leg's broken. He's useless as a commodity. So if they euthanize him, they get the $5 million in insurance. Whereas if they rehabilitate him, the insurance doesn't pay off. Is that more or less why they execute them?
Guys who are in trouble, financial trouble, it's like, you know, torching your building. Some guys, horse riders, it's a cold business. It's a very cold, cruel world back there, no question. But there's a lot of ups and downs, and I thought that the series portrayed it well, but I understand it because I've done some gambling.
Mike, it says you're a jockey?
I used to be a jockey agent. That was years ago, though.
Really? Amazing. It's a whole universe I know nothing about. How much do jockeys make a year?
The top 15, they probably make about $1 million to $1.5 million. And then it goes down from like the next 50. I'm talking about ranking.
Right. So how, are these guys really still short and small? And there are women jockeys now, correct?
I'll tell you something about jockeys. I used to play poker in the back stretch of Beaumont racetrack years ago, 20 years ago. And
right.
I saw a guy who was a jockey literally get in a fight over a poker game. He's an exercise rider trainer, but he was a former jockey. And a guy was outweighed him by 120 pounds, and he beat him. It was a fight. It was a brawl. I got 230 pounds fighting this guy, 125 pounds.
But why is that? Why are they so tough? What are they from the? Explain that to me.
Well, if you watched in the series, the young girl, the one he didn't like with the S-word.
Yes.
She was galloping a horse for that Nick Nolte character. And when she was done with that workout, she said, this horse has got 9 gears left. And if you saw her, she was panting coming off that horse. And it is extremely physically.
Oh, you mean running a horse around a track is very demanding on the jockey himself.
You have to be fit. You have to be absolutely fit to just go around the track a mile and a half. And that's
right, I can believe that. No, I can believe that. It's like riding a bicycle. I mean, you're controlling. How much of those, whatever it weighs, you're still controlling its destiny, correct?
Yeah, it's going to go 45 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an interesting world. All I'm saying is, as a piece of art, it didn't work for me. I didn't understand it. The characters made no sense. And one, the last thing, Mike, you've been around racetracks all your life. Can Dustin Hoffman, does he look like a gangster to you?
Well, that's an interesting point. I understand where you're coming from. And I think he played in that Dutch Schultz movie a few years ago.
Yes, he played in the Billy Bathgate. Again, he always wants to be a gangster. Why does he have an obsession with wanting to be a gangster?
I my feeling about that is I know a few, interesting characters, only put it in quotes that way. And I don't think you have to be physically tough to be a gangster.
I agree with you, but if you want to be a criminal, why not get a law degree or go to work for the government?
Nice point.
No, I hate to make a leap now, and I'm not accusing him of anything. Here's John Corzine, former chairman of Goldman Sachs, then a senator from New Jersey, Then he runs MF Global. $1.2 billion is missing, and the man says he doesn't know where it is, and he's not been indicted. How is that possible?
And did you hear in the Wall Street Journal today they're not going to be able to try to trace that money?
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm saying. But he's not responsible for it?
How is he not going to do time? I don't understand.
I don't know why he hasn't been taken out in handcuffs. They take people out of boiler rooms for doing things illegally with stocks with far less of a loss. How could the guy say he doesn't know where $1.2 billion is and not be indicted? The answer is because he's a Democrat. He's tied into the Obama administration. This is the greatest scandal I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, that's a bad $1.2 billion.
But I agree with your main point, Mike, that you don't have to be a big, brawly, tough guy to be a gangster. Totally right. The muscle is one side, the brains are another. I hear you.
And I think, didn't he play something in Pulp Fiction? Or was that Dustin Hoffman? I'm not sure.
I don't even know. No, but I agree with you. It's about, you know, figuring things out. But as I say today, why do you have to go into a criminal enterprise when you can get a law degree and go into government? I'll be right back.
Savage.
Back to the program. You know, in about 10 minutes, Alan West will be on, Congressman West. I love this guy because he was a war hero to me and to anyone else who understands reality. And to the rat Democrats, they try to make him into a war criminal. I mean, this to me summarizes the world we're living in. To the Democrat rats, a war hero is a war criminal. To those of us who love the country, we love our war heroes. Period. End of story. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz is not qualified at any speed to talk about Alan West, as far as I'm concerned. Let me show you what Gingrich, how low he's getting. Today, he's appearing before a Jewish audience yesterday, Gingrich, in Florida. They're fighting for the Cuban vote, the Cuban vote, the Jewish vote, the lizard vote, God knows what. He's speaking to 50 Jewish people in an old age home. Gingrich now, the show of Desmond. And he says, Romney vetoed funding for kosher meals in 2003. I got to get a kick out of this, how low this Gingrich character is. Beyond belief. He said that Governor Romney, as governor, vetoed $600,000 in additional funds for nursing home residents to get kosher meals, which would have cost $5 more per day because it would unnecessarily lead to an increased rate for nursing facilities. Well, okay, where's the money supposed to come from? How about halal meals? Now, everyone should have a halal meal in an Islamic nursing home, a kosher meal in a Jewish nursing home. Who's supposed to pay for everybody's preferences? There's no endless money here. So that's Gingrich now. That's what he's down to. This is what he's down to. Now, are you saying, are you really in love with Romney? The answer is no. I know Romney's a liberal. I know Romney's going to disappoint. I have no expectations from him. But the fact of the matter is I will sleep better at night. I will not fear the FBI. I will not fear the DHS. I would not fear naval intelligence doing things against American citizens under Romney as I would under this character in the White House now. Period. End of story. That's how I see it. And if you think I'm alone, you're mistaken. America lives in fear of this regime, which is just what they want because they know that they're detested. And they know the only way to get on top of the people in this country is like Assad in Syria, which is to scare the heck out of them. Vicky in Sacramento, welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Savage. I'm one of the five women that listen to you Monday through Friday. I just want to tell you that I have five rats.
Now, come on, really? What do you see in a rat?
They're not
political. Are they a step up from the men you were dating? Is that why?
They're very much like dogs. Very intelligent. They know their names. They're not political. They have short hair. They don't smell. They're easy to keep clean. And they like me.
I don't understand it, though. Why a rodent?
I don't know.
Can you empathize with a rodent the way you could with a poodle?
No, I love Teddy, too. He's adorable.
But how did you get into rats? I mean, how does this happen? How does an ordinarily intelligent woman become a rat lover?
Well, I went to a pet store, and the woman told me that one of these beautiful rats was going to be snake food, and it broke my heart. And the next thing I know, I took her home. And then I had to get her a companion.
So it kind of
went on from there.
Oh, God. They breed like rats, though, don't they?
No, I don't have any babies. They're all females.
I rest my case. I don't want to do any more rat jokes, but this is amazing. I mean, there are people who have rats as pets. It's a crazy world. I'm bewildered by it. I am absolutely bewildered by it. But look how that tied into Ratso Rizzo as a character when you think about it. You know, Wyoming, Matthew, welcome to the program. You're on the Savage Nation.
Yes, I just wanted to comment a bit, being a large animal veterinarian, about the
problem. I would love to learn more about why they euthanize a racehorse who breaks his leg.
Yes, and I was going to get into that. Those horses have so much weight that when you take the weight off in one leg, that it puts so much pressure on the other one that the small bone in the foot generally rotates and goes out through the sole. And they call that foundering, and so then the horse is virtually useless, not only on the broken leg, but the other leg as well. And so, just
unbelievable. So explain to me then, this is obviously not a natural state, or all the horses out there, the wild horses as well. So why do race horses have such top-heavy bodies and such thin bone legs?
Well, for speed, probably, primarily. Breeding for longer legs, for more reach. Because
so it's a matter of genetic engineering in that sense. I mean, naturally, but so
yeah.
You're picking horses with longer legs for the stride, and yet those legs are not strong enough for the body.
Right. And now the Mustangs that would be out just free ranging and taking care of themselves generally are more short legged and big feet, kind of homely looking. Most of us would not like.
So I would be a Mustang if I were a horse. I wouldn't be a thoroughbred on a racetrack. I would be definitely a Mustang that evolved through time with short, stubby, strong legs.
Well, to each their own, I guess.
Yeah, no, but seriously, you really have educated me, Matthew. They, you know, as a kind of amateur looking in, I'd never understood why they euthanized the racehorse.
Well, not only that, the success of doing surgeries on animals that big, most of our plates and those sorts of things that we use in humans and in dogs are not successful. Because they can't tolerate, like, when that big muscle begins to pull, a lot of them bend or break.
Mm. Well, I think veterinarians are saints, frankly. I've always felt people who devote themselves to animals to begin with have a good heart. And I really appreciate you joining us today on the Savage Nation. It's been great. I love learning things, you know. I love learning things like that. Let's go to Tucson, Arizona. Peggy, welcome to the program. Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much, Michael. I appreciate you taking my call. I am very concerned about your favorite congressman, Alan West, being his district is being redistricted out of existence by Republicans.
Yes. Why are the Republicans gerrymandering Alan West out of business? You know the answer, don't you?
Because he's Tea Party.
Because he's too conservative. They want another team playing, check-pants, useless Republicrat.
Two districts down there, and yet...
No, I know. He's amazing how he pulled together so many disparate elements, the Floridian, the Jewish voter, the Cuban voter, the, you know, amazing. And along the beaches, the beachfront was his. You know, I have a house down in that area I rarely go to, but astounding to me that he was able to do this. See, I had him to my house, by the way, 2 years ago with his wife and lovely daughters. They're wonderful people. They're an honor to have in your house. How could they do this to him?
I don't know, but I'm wondering if there's anything can be done about it.
Well, he's going to be on this show in exactly 7 minutes. We're going to ask him. That's a super question. He's going to talk about why he said things that agitated the most incendiary DNC chair in history, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And what he thinks about the gerrymandering of his district by fellow repubes.
Really?
In exactly, a few minutes here on the Savage Nation. We have wonderful callers. If you care to join the conversation, you'll speak with an awful lot of people and be heard by them. Whether you want to talk about Hollywood, a new term I think I created today, unless someone says they stole it from me 10 years ago or something like that. I'll be right back.
Savage.
This is a battlefield that we must stand upon. And we need to let President Obama, Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi,
Take your message of equality of achievement. Take your message of economic dependency. Take your message of enslaving the entrepreneurial will and spirit of the American people somewhere else. You can take it to Europe. You can take it to the bottom of the sea. You can take it to the North Pole. But get the hell out of the United States of America.
Whoa. Ooh, someone got mad. Somebody got mad, and that someone joins us right now, one of my favorites in Congress, Congressman Alan West. An honor to have you on the Savage Nation.
Well, Dr. Savage, first let me say Happy New Year to you and your wife, and it's great being back on with you and sharing with the Savage Nation. Thank you.
Well, there's a lot to be said here. I'm sure that people are outraged that you dare say a thing like this. What's the heat been like?
Well, you know, I don't care about the heat because I have to tell the truth. And I think that there are times when you have to tell the American people what they need to hear and not what they may want to hear. And we don't need to sugarcoat this anymore. There is a message out there that is the antithesis to everything that we are as a constitutional republic, and it does not belong here on these shores. And I think that if this message continues to permeate throughout our nation, we're looking at the future and the legacy of this America that we should be all in love with be lost for our children and grandchildren.
Absolutely. In fact, if Obama is not stopped at the ballot box, we're going to lose the nation completely. Look at this story, Congressman West. Obama administration offers $75,000 grants to sign up more food stamp recipients. Can you believe a thing like this?
Yeah, well, once again, you have to get inside of his head and also the head of the liberal progressives. If they can get more people dependent upon them, dependent upon government, than there are out there producing, then they're going to win. It's just a sheer numbers game. And I think that when you go back and you read a book like Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, or you read many of your books, you see exactly the roadmap that these guys have, and that is to get more people on food stamps. You've seen a 16% increase of people on the poverty rolls. To get more people that are sitting back saying, what will the government do for me, instead of unleashing that entrepreneurial spirit and American will, which is what I talked about, and that's what we have to get back to.
Over the last 3 years, Congressman, the number of Americans on food stamps has skyrocketed by two-thirds. Mm-hmm. It stands at a record high. 46 million citizens, or one out of seven people in the U.S., is on food stamps. But apparently that's not enough for the Obamaites. They want more people, and they're offering $75,000 grants to groups who devise strategies to increase program participation. Why in the world are they allowed to get away with this? Where is Congress?
Well, you know, that's one of the things that we have to stand up and fight against. You know, when Newt Gingrich said food stamp president, he tried to get some heat. I went on news shows, and I said he's absolutely right. So I think that one of the things we have to look at is they have to come to the House of Representatives. We're the keepers of the purse, and we just won't allow them to have that. And
they can't do this by
Yes.
I'm sorry. So they can't just do this by fiat, give out that grant?
No, they can't do it. There are things that they can do by regulatory fiat, and I think you see that coming out of the NLRB. You see that coming out of the EPA. But you just can't start writing off money. As a matter of fact, the Obama administration is already about 2 to 3 weeks late on presenting their budget for fiscal year 2013, which you would think in the last year of his presidency they would be able to do. But then again, he's out campaigning all over the country. So, you know, creating a budget is not that important since we've gone close to about 1,007 days without having one.
What do you need a budget for? If you have Air Force One and a host of servants in the White House, what do you need a budget for? The nation comes last. Congressman, a caller asked me in the last segment about you and your district, and she alleged, and I think it's true, that your fellow Republicans are going to gerrymander your district out from under you. Is there any truth to that?
Yes, right now that seems to be the case. The Republicans in Florida have a supermajority in the House and the Senate. They have taken my district and made it about 4 to 5 percentage points stronger for Democrats. And I can't explain it. I don't understand it. There were many great citizens down here that are constituents of this district that supplied them with maps that would have met all the legal standards of Amendment 6 down here and also the Voting Rights Act. But, you know, it is what it is, and I'll just have to fight hard.
But why are they doing it? Is it because you're too conservative? They say because you're a Tea Party favorite? The Republican Party, is that disconnected from the will of their own base that they would do this?
Well, I think that you would probably have to call the Speaker of the House designate there and the President of the Senate, call the folks in the Florida legislature and ask them, because I can't explain it. And as a matter of fact, I'm just trying to do my best to be a good congressional representative for the people here. As a matter of fact, we had a hearing down here today about this oil rig that is about to be in place about 60 miles off Florida's shore, which the Obama administration has been providing technical advice and guidance. It's a Chinese-made rig. It's a Spanish company, and they're going to start drilling off the coast, something that we're not allowed to do.
What in the heck? I know that there are something like 9 foreign nations drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, yet Obama prohibits Americans from drilling in the Gulf?
Yeah, well, that's in the Gulf. We're talking actually right off of Cuba's coast. And if you understand the Gulf Stream, and this is in waters that are deeper than Deepwater Horizon, if there is a catastrophic event, you're looking at South Florida just being absolutely decimated and our economy being destroyed. And let's not forget that 2 weeks ago, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was visiting Cuba, and I'm sure they were talking about strengthening their ties.
Astounding what's going on in this under this administration.
And
I have to agree with your emotional outburst when you said they should leave the country, because they do not represent American values. There's no question. That's what you meant.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I didn't, you know, direct that toward individuals. I directed it toward their message. Their message of equality of opportunity, that's not America. America's about equality of, equality of achievement. America's about equality of opportunity. Their message is about economic dependency. America is about economic freedom. And, of course, how they are enslaving the entrepreneurial will, which is causing so many small businesses to close up so that Americans have to be more dependent upon government. I want to unleash that entrepreneurial spirit and get capital flowing out here so we can get more storefronts open back up. So
Why do you think that the Democrats chose such a I'm going to try to use a polite description of Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Why have they chosen such a provocative, angry, distasteful human being to be their chairman?
Well, I think that, you know, my colleague from down here in Florida, she represents the liberal progressives that are now running the Democrat Party.
You mean they're just all mean-spirited, foul-mouthed attack dogs?
Well, I think that that's what you see. And I think, you know, the sooner that the Republican Party understands that this is a bare-knuckle fist fight, they will, you know, maybe be victorious in this upcoming election. But if they think that this is going to be a nice, simple, fair fight, I want to tell them a lesson that I learned from a Marine first sergeant by the name of Jim Reifinger. He said, if you ever find yourself in a fair fight, it's all because your tactics suck. This is not going to be a fair fight.
No, it isn't. And that's what worries me about Romney. When I heard about a few months ago, he said, oh, Obama's a good man. He's just over his head. I said, oh, my God. Here we go. It's John McCain all over again. That's why McCain lost in the last election.
Now, we can no longer be a punching bag for the liberals, and, you know, that's why I'm the number one target for the Democrat Party, because I see them for who they are, and I'm willing to call them out on it. I just hope and wish that my fellow Republicans from top to bottom will do the exact same and not isolate those of us who want to stand up for principle with pragmatic passion behind it.
Well, before you leave us today in the Savage Nation, because we're going to go back after you leave to something far less important, which is horse racing and HBO's drama called Luck and all of that stuff, what can people do who are concerned about what the Republicans are doing to you? That's what worries me. Here you are, a Republican star. You're a true conservative. You're a war hero. Why are they trying to cut the legs out from under you by redistricting your own district, meaning gerrymandering you out of business? What are they trying to achieve here?
If I could answer that, I would get $1 million. I think that, you know, maybe you can call up to the Florida legislature and see if they'd be willing to come on your show and explain it. And the good people in the Savage Nation can contact the Florida legislature and, you know, ask them a very simple question, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
I hear you. Congressman West, always a pleasure. By the way, I hope the next time that I'm in Florida and you're down there, we can say hello again. In regards to your lovely family.
My family would love to see you again, sir, and thank you so much.
And by the way, I know what they like now for food.
Yeah, pretty
simple. No, I remember we had a whole bunch of Italian food out. Everybody liked the same exact dish. I didn't have enough of it.
No, it was great, and I look forward to breaking bread with you again.
All right, thanks. Thank you again, Congressman Alan West. Imagine if we had, let's say, net 100%. Could you imagine what this country would be like if we had 25% of Congress as authentic frontline combat troops come back and want to serve America in Congress? Can you imagine the different world we'd be in? Can you imagine if 1% of reporters were former combat veterans instead of about 0.00001%? What a different country this would be. You know, 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. I have some great callers. We want to jump back to Joe in New York in a minute because we were talking about horses before. I can't believe this call. I hope it's true. Joe, are you there on WOR on line 4? Joe, welcome to the program. Go ahead, please.
Hi, yes. Well, I have an uncle that did the props on the first Godfather film.
Yeah.
And he, you know, the scene with the horse's head.
Yeah.
Classic scene.
Well, oh, yeah.
That prop, he got that horse's head from a Bronx slaughterhouse. And he took it home to touch it up a little bit because he had to make sure that that white streak down the front of the horse's face made it look more authentic, like a thoroughbred.
So, unbelievable.
So, I mean, that's sort of...
So, wait, but Joe, this was not a real horse's head, right?
It was. I told you, yeah, he got it from a slaughterhouse.
No, but wait, let me see if he made the prop. So he took a slaughterhouse... A live piece of, yeah, but wait, he could not put a head that had been on a live horse.
They use corn syrup for the blood.
No, but why wouldn't it stink after weeks? I mean, it had to be sent from the Bronx, then it had to in Hollywood for a few weeks. How long was it there?
I'm not sure about that detail, but this is from his mouth.
I mean, look, if you bought a steak today, if you went to a market in New York right now and you bought a steak. And you left it out of the refrigerator for a few days. Wouldn't it smell?
It would. It would start rotting, yeah. I don't know.
Hey, come on now. Maybe your uncle was giving you a little BS there, Joe.
Nah. This
In any case, it's an interesting call. The time is 46 minutes after the hour. I'll be right back.
Why don't you say you work for Corleone, Tom? I thought you were just some cheap two-bit hustler Johnny was running in trying to bluff me.
I don't like to use his name unless it's really necessary.
How's your drink, Tom?
Fine.
Hey, come on over here with me. I want to show you something really beautiful. You do appreciate beauty, don't you? They are $600,000 on four hooks. I'll bet Russian Tsar never paid that kind of dough for a single horse. I'm not going to race him, though. I'm going to put him out to stud.
That was a great scene, Charles. Thanks very much for pulling that for the entertainment of my audience. We've been talking about horses, horse racing, the flopped HBO drama with Dustin. Not only was it imperceptible, I couldn't follow it, enigmatic. He's trying to show how artsy he is. I guess art, if you can't follow it, you're stupid. Something along those lines. And will I watch it again? Yes. I'll pray to God it gets better. I may even go to the track in Berkeley when it opens this year. I haven't been there in 15 years. I'm a very lucky man. I have no addiction. I don't have a gambling addiction. It's an amazing thing when you consider how people get lost in gambling and their lives go up they're ruined. Their lives are ruined. I had a gambling phase in my life, age 11. I bought a roulette wheel and a green cloth, and I did gambling in my basement in Queens. I was smart enough to get the roulette wheel and the green felt. But I was addicted for about a year to gambling. And I read years later as I was studying psychology that gambling is, I don't want to offend anybody because you're going to take it the wrong way. It has to do with a sexual something or other. I couldn't follow exactly. But it occurs in boys when they're about 11. And if they get stuck, they're stuck in an 11-year-old phase. I mean, you've asked wives of so-called degenerate gamblers, they'll tell you the husband was 11 years old his whole life anyway, in many ways, not just in gambling. But I got out of it very quickly. That was the end of that. And I'm going to go to the racetrack. What, I'm going to bet? How do you pick a horse? I don't even know how you pick one. Name? What's it called? A name? You like a name? You know, unless you're really an expert, you start a handicapper and a this and a that. But I don't know whether I would sit upstairs in the boxes or with the downstairs with the on the rail. I don't like being indoors. What am I going to track if I can't hear the mud and the horse and smell it going by? I'm going to go sit upstairs. I can watch television at home, so I won't go. Now I decided I'm not going. That's all. I decided I'm not. I talked myself out of it. There's nothing to do anywhere. It's like going to a track to watch a car race. I analyze it the same way. I was down at the track at Indianapolis years ago, and my son sponsored a car. I loved it, the noise and the gas. But then again, after a while, the noise and the gas smells get to you. I'd rather watch it on television. The best part of going to the Indianapolis Speedway for me 5 years ago, you know what it was? When that B-1 bomber flew overhead, I was just knocked out by it. I have no idea why we have one. I don't know what it's used for. I mean, I like to see it used in Afghanistan and a few other places on Earth. But when the crowd's standing there before the race, and all of a sudden you look up and the stealth B-1 bomber comes over, you didn't even hear it approaching, and there it is overhead, it takes your breath away. The whole crowd cheered and jumped for joy. Wasn't used. Don't use it for anything. The most advanced bomber on Earth, not used. What's the point of it? What do we have all of these weapon systems for if we do not use them? I don't understand this. Instead, we send our neighbor's sons out to die for politicians in Washington, D.C.? For what? New York City, WOR, Lawrence, I think you're going to be one of the last up in this hour. What's on your mind?
About The Godfather, that was mostly shot in New York, so they could go to a Bronx slaughterhouse and get that horse's head.
That's interesting. What do you mean? You mean that mansion that they showed in Hollywood Hills was just shown, but it wasn't inside there?
Juxtapose they can do.
Where was it shot in? Where was that man? So when they did the scene outside in the garden with the movie producer, where was that scene shot?
They went to Hollywood for some locations, but I know that the horse's head took place here only because it was a real horse's head, I have been told by.
I see. So the bed scene could have been done in a studio anywhere, for example.
Queen's boy was born in Flushing, and remember, I think my father surveyed your home on Utopia Parkway when you lived there.
He surveyed it? What do you mean, he was a surveyor?
An engineer and a surveyor. Yes, I am, too.
Isn't that something? God, those houses still bring back memories to me on Utopia Parkway. What a name. What a name for a person's life. What a title for a person's autobiography, Utopia Parkway. You know, it's like Paradise Drive, Utopia Parkway. All of these optimistic names from the 1950s when people thought that if you moved into a clean, safe, suburb, life was going to be a utopia or paradise. Little did they know that the human mind was a little different than that. That you can put a human being in the most perfect surroundings. And by the way, who's to say that a sterile surrounding is a perfect utopia anyway? I myself tend to like a little bit of the wild side, the gritty side, which draws me back and forth. I still can't decide which side of the street I want to live on. Isn't that a bizarre thing? Here I go to Mar-a-Lago for Christmas dinner with my family and Donald Trump, and I really love it, right? And then on the other hand, I can't wait to get back into the streets of San Francisco, almost the underbelly, not quite, because I like the grit and I like the whole scene with the people. Truthfully, I don't really belong in either one. And so therefore, I belong only in one place, and that's on the microphone, where my feet can live in two worlds at once, if not 10. This is the Savage Nation. You can go to michaelsavage.com or listen for another big hour. Tomorrow is the Florida primary beginning, while we're on the air.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
big one is that tomorrow night is the primary in Florida, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. I'm reviewing today a new HBO series with Dustin Hoffman called Luck. My headline is No Luck with Luck. Ratso Rizzo returns on HBO. It was horrible. It was horrible. There's Ratso Rizzo 40 years later playing a noble gangster, which is nonsense. I don't know why Dustin Hoffman thinks he can get away with this, nor do I know why men from his background continuously try to be gangsters in movies. Do you agree with the Boston Globe, who called Dustin Hoffman's character on the HBO series a crook with the soul of an accountant? Well, most of you don't have HBO, so let's ask you this question. We've been talking about it. Do you think Hollywood is broken because 60s hippies like Dustin Hoffman still run the show with their warped, childish attitudes? Why do you think Hollywood is so anti-American? Why do you think Hollywood is so anti-family? And who was the least convincing actor playing a gangster that you've seen in the last 30 years? Dustin Hoffman, Warren Beatty, or who? These are some of the questions we've been covering on The Savage Nation. Now, you know, a picture is worth 1,000 words, and sound bites are worth 1,000 pictures, which means they're worth 100 words. Today on The Savage Nation, we've been playing sound bites from the trailer for the new HBO series that Dustin Hoffman and Nick Nolte are in called Luck.
A man gets out of jail 3 years, maybe takes a trip to some island somewhere. You get out a month, buy a piece of my racetrack.
I admit I'm halfway nervous.
You think you're the first front in history?
I think, Mr. Bernstein, something personal is going on here.
Some people lying is like breathing. Good luck.
I always want to wonder if you might be pissed off.
You suspect me? I take a fall protecting how many people?
Everyone appreciates what you did, Ace.
You got qualms?
Absolutely.
You want to toss me? 3 years!
I don't trust anyone, not even myself.
You don't know how special you are, do you? How you get around?
Florida Republican Representative Alan West tells Harry Reid, Pelosi, and Obama to get the hell out of the USA. This is amazing. Thank God someone says it. West, a combat veteran, says this is a battlefield that we must stand upon, and we need to let President Obama, Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, and the chairman of the Democrat National Committee, that vile creature from Florida, those are my words, he said we need to let them know that Florida is not on the table. Take your message of equality of achievement, take your message of economic dependency, and take your message of enslaving the entrepreneurial will and spirit of the American people somewhere else. You can take it to Europe. You can take it to the bottom of the sea. You can take it to the North Pole. But get the hell out of the United States of America, said Alan West, a congressman from Florida.
This is a battlefield that we must stand upon. And we need to let President Obama, Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, and my dear friend, the chairman of the Democrat National Committee. We need to let them know that Florida ain't on the table. Take your message of equality of achievement. Take your message of economic dependency. Take your message of enslaving the entrepreneurial will and spirit of the American people somewhere else. You can take it to Europe, you can take it to the bottom of the sea, you can take it to the North Pole, but get the hell out of the United States of America.
Leaders from Oakland, California are outraged by the vandalization and violence of the Occupy protests and the lack of response by the useless mayor.
Mayor Gene Kwan walked news crews through Oakland's vandalized City Hall in the aftermath of Saturday's Occupy Oakland blitz.
The irony of this room is this is the room where we have our new homeowner program. This like help low-income people get housing, and we will have experts on Monday in here checking to make sure that our fire alarm system still works. So they cut the wires in the electrical box here.
Vandals forced open City Hall doors, Kwan says, and ransacked what they could in a quick hit and run.
But this is probably the saddest damage. We got this for the museum. We think this was the original architect's model. So this is over 100 years old. It's pretty badly damaged.
Apparently, the chairman of the RNC was listening to The Savage Nation, and he compared President Obama to the Italian cruise ship cabin.
In a few months, this is all going to be ancient history, and we're going to talk about our own little Captain Scatino, which is President Obama, who's abandoning the ship here in the United States and is more interested in campaigning than doing his job as president.
What did you just say? What did you call President Obama?
I called him Captain Scatino, you know, the captain that fled the ship in Italy. That's our own president who's fleeing the American people and not doing his job and running around the country and campaigning.
The most incendiary Democrat, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, said comparing Obama to the cruise ship captain is incendiary and he should apologize.
This is a person who's been, the captain of the Costa Concordia has been charged with manslaughter.
Right.
And for the RNC chairman to compare the president of the United States to someone who's been charged with manslaughter shows a dramatic level of insensitivity to the families of those victims. Unbelievable comparison. I'm not going to give any credence to those incendiary remarks.
Do you think that he shouldn't have been compared to the cruise ship captain? I don't. Senator John Dodo McCain said, "We've got to stop the debates." I guess someone finally got the whole. He was busy going from show to show. Old John McCain woke up 6 months after old Savage.
We've got to stop the debates. Enough with the debates. Because they are driving up our candidates, all of them, unfavorabilities. We've had enough of that. They've turned into a mud wrestling instead of exposition of the candidates' views on the issues. We've had enough of that. And it's time to recognize who the real adversary is, and that's not each other.
Then, of course, there was Newt Gingrich, the sourpuss on Fox News. I won't even say what he said. Then there was old Ron Paul clinking along there, following his neurons trailing him. On some show or other. So that's some of the sound we had today. But, I mean, there's a lot more we've been talking about. And we can continue to do so by going to michaelsavage.com together. Top left, Obama, the most polarizing president ever. Who said it? Washington Post. Not me. Top right, Alan West, the liberals, take your message and get the hell out. Good for you, Congressman West. DNC chair, the deranged, hysterical, angry, DNC chair says comparing Obama to the cruise captain is incendiary. What does she mean by that? You mean what Obama says is not incendiary? Egyptian Islamists are building on their overtaking of the Egyptian government. Remember John Corzine, Obama's good friend, Democrat. MF Global client money feared gone. That's only $1.2 billion missing. He's still not been indicted for this, or rather even arrested. He's a Democrat, you see. Is global warming done? Scientists now predict a mini ice age. 200 laid off at North Las Vegas solar plant just after months after Obama visited. I guess it served its purpose like agitprop in the Soviet Union. College presidents call Obama's campaign promises baloney. Old Biden says he was against the Bin Laden raid. I guess he figured the SEALs couldn't use water guns over there. Also on Michael Savage, terribly sad story. Muslim family in Canada convicted of honor killing three daughters. Honor killing? You call that honor? I would call it the most cowardly, dishonorable thing you could do. I don't care whether it's in the name of a religion. New York Times is at it again, glorifying a violent communist with a nose ring from South America. So way cool. Candidate in Arizona wants on the ballot without knowing English. She's suing. Savage's USA Today column, Marines' Honor Desecrated by the Media. I don't know if you've seen it. You should read it. The world's ugliest animals. You got to see those pictures. Police roll out video surveillance truck called a peacemaker. That's nice. We're living increasingly in a Soviet Union. Disgraced teacher in New York City makes $100,000 a year doing nothing. That's because he's in a system shackled by protections for tenured teachers. What's wrong with the teenage mind, asks the Wall Street Journal with a picture of James Dean. All this and more on michaelsavage.com. For all the latest headlines, that's your one-stop shop. As news breaks in this hour, you're going to hear about it, believe me. It's all Florida, 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 Florida. But we'll be talking about things other than Florida today.
Savage.
In a few months, this is all going to be ancient history, and we're going to talk about our own little Captain Scatino, which is President Obama, who's abandoning the ship here in the United States and is more interested in campaigning than doing his job as president.
What did you just say? What did you call President Obama?
I called him Captain Scatino, you know, the captain that fled the ship in Italy. That's our own president who's fleeing the American people and not doing his job and running around the country and campaigning.
This is a person who's been, the captain of the Costa Concordia has been charged with manslaughter.
Right.
And for the RNC chairman to compare the president of the United States to someone who's been charged with manslaughter shows a dramatic level of insensitivity to the families of those victims. Unbelievable comparison. I'm not going to give any credence to those incendiary remarks.
Wow, you know how much that irritates me. Well, imagine how your throat will get this winter without Pine Brothers Softish Throat Drops. That's right. I'm talking about Pine Brothers Softish Throat Drops we all grew up with. They're back in natural honey and wild cherry flavors. Pine Brothers has been a trusted brand since 1870. Visit them on the web at pinebrothers.com. That's pinebrothersyum.com. I'm going to lighten things up a little bit because it gets too hot. We got to slow her down. We'll come back to very strong politics in a minute. Many people would like me to read from Abuse of Power. I don't know if I can give you. All right, I'll read you this paragraph. Tel Aviv, Israel, way into the book in the middle of it. Welcome to the city that never sleeps, the Reb said as they exited the highway. Traffic was light on the new express lane into Tel Aviv and the drive-in from Ben-Gurion International Airport had taken them only 20 minutes. Rabbi Mel Nirsham had come in from San Francisco on an earlier flight to make the appropriate arrangements for Jack's arrival. Jack had known Nirsham for many years now. They'd met through a mutual acquaintance, Bill Hicks, a private detective. Hicks and Hatfield frequented the same restaurant, a place on Columbus, the North Beach restaurant, where they both liked to eat at the bar as they watched the crowd coming and going while they talked what they called the unholy trinity, sports and politics and religion. The city's ruling elite still ate there. Pelosi, Brown, the former mayor, all the known and hidden power brokers. One night, Hatfield brought up his disenchantment with the Catholic Church, echoing his father's own discontent, and complained that it had lost its edge and become too pacifist. No fire, no brimstone. If you're looking for fire and brimstone, Hicks said, you should check out my old friend, Rabbi Nirsham, toughest Jew I know. The more he heard about this rebellious Rebbe, hence the Reb, the more curious Jack got. Although he'd been raised Catholic, he'd always been attracted to his mother's history and culture. So a few days later, he set up a meet with Nirsham, discovered a kindred soul, and the two became instant friends. And when the Reb found out Hatfield had Jewish blood, he insisted Jack join him and his friends on Friday nights for prayer, vodka, and a home-cooked meal, an invitation Jack had accepted more than once. This is from Abuse of Power, page 169. Hicks had been right. Nirsham was a tough old Jew. The product of an Orthodox day school, the Reb had fallen out of love with Judaism in his late teens and, much to his parents' dismay, decided to rebel. He was a hippie in the 60s, later a boxer. Then in his middle years, he rediscovered his roots with a fierce passion and spent 5 years studying Jewish law at a rabbinical seminary in New York. This was followed by a year in Israel before returning to San Francisco as an ordained rabbi. The Reb was a black hat, a Chabad Lubavitch Hasid, who often spent weeks at a time in Tel Aviv. Jack himself hadn't been here in years. The first thing he noticed now was how much the place had grown. Comparisons to New York were no longer as laughable as they'd once been. Tel Aviv was a thriving metropolis perched on the edge of the Mediterranean. Everything about it screamed big city. So where are we headed, he asked the rabbi as they took the exit. First, we do something about those clothes. Jack was wearing jeans and a suede leather jacket. You want to blend in with us? You'll have to look the part. Hatfield had once asked him why Hasidic Jews always wore dark clothing. And Nirsham explained they were more concerned with what was on the inside rather than what was fashionable. In fact, these Hasids wore 19th century Polish business garb. They were stuck in a fashion time warp. I'm not so sure about blending in, Jack said. If I dressed like you, I'd probably look more like Johnny Cash than Menachem Schneerson. The rabbi smiled. Bring a guitar, you'll get all the girls. Anyway, I won't read you anymore because it starts to give away too much of the plot. Some of the lines are very funny, by the way. Let's see. All right, I'll read you a little bit more because it's fun. Page 171. I'm trying to skip plot elements so that you go out and you read the book yourself. Let's see. It hadn't taken much convincing to get the rabbi involved in Jack's plight. The Reb was rumored to have connections to both Mossad and the Israeli mafia. And while he wasn't a violent man, he'd never shied from a good fight. He was also known to quote Rabbi Meir Kahane, the founder of the Radical Jewish Defense League, who was assassinated in a Manhattan hotel room in 1990 by persons unknown. Every Jew, a 22, the Reb had said more than once. A staunch proponent of the Second Amendment, the Reb had always supported a well-armed citizenry, which he believed was the only way to keep another Castro or Stalin or Hitler or Chavez from rising in America. The one thing that stops an evil government from seizing total power, he once told Jack, is fear of millions of armed citizens. The Brits learned that lesson a couple of hundred years ago. Yet despite his tough talk, the Reb was genuinely a kind and friendly man. He acted as a missionary to fallen Jews he met in the streets of San Francisco, trying to bring them back to God. He'd saved many a drugged-out soul over the years, and they loved him for throwing them a spiritual life preserver when they were drowning. In some ways, Jack was in need of a life preserver himself, and once he told his story, the Reb was all too happy to help. Michael Savage, Abuse of Power, the finest novel written about San Francisco since Jack London, in my opinion. And it's in my humble opinion. I wouldn't say it if I actually didn't believe it. I mean, you think it's tongue-in-cheek, you're mistaken. My descriptions of San Francisco and of the Bay and of boating have never been surpassed by anybody that I know of, or I wouldn't have written the book. I guarantee it.
Savage.
The Occupy Communist protesters are back causing ruckus in Oakland and Washington, D.C., as they've been trained to do. Over 700 have been arrested. Joining us right now is investigative reporter for the Heritage Foundation, Lachlan Marquet, who spent today at Occupy D.C. Lachlan Marquet, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Michael, it's great to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
So give my audience, the Savage Nation, your thoughts on this Occupy movement.
Well, I think it's certainly progressed since it first started. Initially, you had people that had what were generally some mainstream political opinions in terms of ending cronyism in the American political system, the outsized influence that a few can have over the process. But as police forces around the country have started to clear them out, certainly this has been the case in D.C., although police have tended to be less aggressive there. The people who have really remained are the more hardcore people, the professional activists, people who have less mainstream political views at heart, and more of the radical, occasionally anarchist, sometimes union-involved political views that stray well outside the mainstream of American political opinion.
What were they like? Did you learn anything we don't know about these bums?
Well, the protest itself was similar to what it was very similar to, you know, I've gone down to Occupy DC a few times now, and you know, it's less aggressive than a lot of the ones around the country, and it seems like most of there's no coherent message, so it's more of an amalgam of a lot of different protest groups. In terms of what I've learned since I've been down there, you know, because there isn't a central message, it's more. You know, what you learn essentially is that there is no central message. There's no coherent political platform that they're pushing for. So what you get is you get your anti-war protesters, you get your union protesters, you get your more hardcore black bloc anarchist protesters. And certainly that was the case today. They're still very determined to not comply with any of the, you know, there's a ban on camping on federal land, and in D.C., of course, the public land there is owned by the federal government. So that was where the police involvement came in, and you really continued to see an antipathy towards that and a view, an erroneous view, if you look at the actual case law, what the Supreme Court has said, that this was what the police were trying to do in clearing out camping equipment on this land was in violation of their First Amendment rights. In fact, that's not the case, and I've written about this over the past week. You know, it's a very skewed understanding of the American political and judicial system, but, you know, you find a lot of these protesters are really on cloud nine with the things that they're saying in terms of corporate dominance of the political process. You know, I think we would all like to see less political cronyism, but when you have a protest group that says the government is corrupt and we demand that they have more power, you can see how there's sort of a disconnect there. You know, that's been true. That's an animating concern of these Occupy protests across the country. Certainly, it's been true in D.C., and it was certainly enforced today.
Between Oakland and Washington, D.C., over 700 of these bums have been arrested. Are the police really doing enough to stop violence? I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think there's much that they could do to stop people who are determined to break the law from breaking the law. The concern, I think, is that they are preventing police from doing their normal law enforcement activities. So in Oakland, for instance, as you mentioned, we had 400 arrests there. The protesters stormed City Hall, vandalized it, torched an American flag right outside. And the mayor came out today and said, you know, we've had 5 murders over the past week in Oakland, and these Occupy protests are not just preventing police from effectively doing their jobs, but draining resources from a police force, you know, and a city government that's already very strapped for cash. So, you know, with these protest groups, and we saw very similar ones at political conventions over the past 10 years, they really started in force during the WTO protests in the late 90s. These are people who go there determined to, they will say it's civil disobedience. It turns out in most cases to not be so civil. So when that happens, you know, the best police can do is try to contain the situation as well as they can, try to prevent innocent bystanders from being hurt, and minimize the damage to property in the area. So I think police have been doing as good of a job as they can at that. The concern, again, is not what they're doing with the Occupy protesters themselves, but what those protesters are preventing them from doing in other parts of the cities that they're working in.
There is evidence that Obama and the Democrats are behind this movement in order to cause a crisis.
I wouldn't say they're behind it. I do think it's very disappointing that they haven't been more forceful in condemning what is clearly a mass showing of lawlessness, occasionally violence. You know, we've seen rapes, we've seen plenty of drug use, of course, massive amounts of vandalism, and even the occasional, if not murder, then at least dead bodies showing up at these protests. So, you know, I would like to see. I think most Americans would like to see a bit of a more forceful reaction from the top people in the federal government, especially given that some of these protests are happening on federal land. Instead, we saw the White House Press Secretary Jay Carney, in response to a question about Occupy Oakland, essentially just punt on it, say, you know, I would defer to local law enforcement authorities. Of course, think back, for example, to 2009 during the incident in Cambridge when Professor Gates was arrested there, and the president didn't seem to have a problem opining on local law enforcement activities. So I think the White House's silence on this is a bit disappointing. And, you know, it's occasional words of often indirect encouragement in terms of the class warrior language that the president continues to use and once again used in his State of the Union address, that certainly doesn't help the situation. And when these protesters see the country's leaders essentially co-opting the same rhetoric of fairness and soak the rich ideology that they themselves are touting at these protests, I think it can only empower them, regardless of whether they say they're supporters of the current administration. So there's a lot more that they could be doing to prevent these sorts of situations from happening. It's disappointing that we haven't seen that happen.
What do you think motivates these street rats?
Well, it really depends on which protester you talk to. There have been a few sort of distinct groups of protesters. As I mentioned towards the beginning of the segment, there initially was a pretty large contingent of your sort of everyday people with everyday political concerns. That's given way to other groups of people that either have a far left-wing agenda, although still, you know, you see some people who belong to union groups or other, you know, more of your conventional liberal protest groups like MoveOn.org, groups affiliated with the former White House official Van Jones. They make up a segment of these protests, and they have more of a realistic mainstream political agenda, but it is a very left-wing agenda. Then you have the professional agitators, the people who were at the WTO protests in the 90s, the people who have raised these ruckuses at political conventions since then, who are 100% against the constitutional order, against free market capitalism, have an extremely radical and often subversive agenda. And those are the people, I think, that are responsible for most of the lawlessness and violence we've seen recently. So certainly there are people motivated by some very nefarious motives, but I wouldn't attribute those to the entire protest movement. It's certainly a diverse crowd.
Lachlan Marquet, thanks for joining us today on The Savage Nation.
Michael, it's been great talking to you, and your listeners can find my work at our blog, foundry.org.
I'm Michael Savage. We'll be right back. Savage. Life is a series of terrors with an occasional plateau of happiness and beauty. If anyone tells you it's the other way around, they're lying to you or they're drug addicts. Life is terrifying. You know what real life is? It's a holy terror. That's why you're born screaming and you die screaming. Do you understand that? Do you understand that, mister? That life is not what the teacher told you. Life is not what these freaks in America are trying to teach your children. Life is a nightmare. It's horrible. That's why you're born screaming. That's why you die screaming. But occasionally, as I said, there is a brief respite here and there. I had one last night. And the tougher you make your kid, the happier your kid's going to be. And the tougher you raise the kid, the happier his life is going to be. And the softer you make your son, the worse his life is going to be. The softer you make your son, the more he's going to be stepped on and turned into a worm. We had a heat wave out here in Northern California for three, four days, and that's what it comes like. And, you know, you live with it. I got air conditioning. I remember when I first moved out here, oh, no, we don't have air conditioning out in these parts. Our fog is on natural air conditioning. Yeah, all right, you're smart, are you smoking? I don't know about you, but I can't take the heat. So I got air conditioning in every house I own. I can turn it into a refrigerator wherever I am. We used to call it Indian summer, but we're not allowed to call it that anymore, so we'll call it Native American summer. We had a Native American summer night. Hot, beautiful. So I figured, you know what, I'm going to fire up the old 65 Caddy convertible. And strangely enough, I bought this car in 1994 when I started in radio. It had 52,000 miles on it. It's red. It's 19 feet, 6 inches long. You know, it's from an era in America that I can remember very well. My father was still alive. It was a different world, right? The windows are almost a half an inch thick on the car. I keep it in the garage. I never drive it, right? I keep a battery charge, trickle charger. Of all the cars you own, I mean, I own some exotic cars, I got to tell you. I'm not here to boast about them, but I do. I'm a machinery lover. It's funny. I mean, given my background and my orientation towards nature, I still love machinery in that I'm a true American in that sense. I grew up in the age of the machine and the engine, and I still love engines. I'm not apologizing about it. In fact, all the freaks who bicycle around here all bring their bikes around with machines and engines. But let's not go there, okay? So I get the car. I bring it down to the house. I have it in the garage. And, you know, I have a dog, Teddy, a 10, 12-pound poodle. He's played as Eddie in my novel, Abuse of Power. He's the show dog. He's the clown. He's 7 years old. He's the joy of my life. Then I have a freak dog, like a retard, Tasha. She's about 5 years old and, like, does nothing for you. Everything is take, take, take. She's like a bad sister-in-law, you know what I'm saying? Or a relative you left behind in Brooklyn. Bitter, nasty, always subbissing her, you know, nothing good to say, always sitting at. And she's nasty. All she wants is food. But we like her, and we take care of her. Teddy's the show dog. She's the dummy. You know how, like, for a horse, you get a goat. Tasha was got to be Teddy's goat, but she doesn't even do that right. All she does is, like, sit around. So I get a surprise last night. I honked the horn to pick up Mrs. S, and she says, I have a surprise for you. I said, what? She said, I got a new dog. I said, oh, God, no. So she got a Havanese, and she named it Toby. So now there's Teddy, Tasha, and Toby. So I said, what am I going to do, get mad? She got a dog? I don't even know what a Havanese is. I said, why not another small? Never mind, I got a Havanese. They're the cutest little thing. They're from Cuba, native to Cuba, which is good because I love Cuban music. And this is, of course, way before the communists destroyed Cuba. There was a nation called Cuba. It's thought that the dogs came from the Canary Islands. Sabor! Okay, good. Beautiful cutting, guys. You're the best. So the Havanese apparently is a lap dog from Cuba's aristocracy, which doesn't exist anymore. But they're very hardy, wonderful, playful little dogs. To make a long story short, he's only seven. I don't know how old he is. I don't know. 7 months. I don't know what he is. So you'd think Teddy and him get along great, right? All I said was, is he house trained? Yes. The first thing he did was pee on the wall. Okay, terrific. Great training job. I'm glad to hear it. But I don't care. You know what I mean? I'd rather have a dog that pees on the wall than relatives of the kind. So I have Teddy, Tasha, and Toby. We pile them into the Cadillac. It's a hot night. What could I tell you? I go for a ride. I get on the highway. I shoot down to Sausalito, go around the waterfront. The car was running better than it's ever run for no reason. So she says to me, why is this car running better than it's ever run? It's smooth. You don't even hear this car. It's like a baby carriage. I own a Mercedes S600. It's a beautiful, incredible car. This thing is smoother, right? And has a certain suspension from the 60s that you can't beat. The dogs, it's a flat seat, right? No bucket seats. This is a flat bench seat. So the dogs love to sit between the two people. The top's down. They love the moon. They love the stars. They love the air. Dogs love the outdoors. And I said to myself, you know what I mean? This is it. This is what life is supposed to be. If you get 15 to 30 minutes of this once a year, you're ahead of the curve. It's not about skyrockets. It's not about getting stoned in a nightclub. It really isn't. Maybe it's about three dogs and a loyal companion in a Cadillac with the top down on a hot night. So that was one story. Now here's another story for you. The other day, I went down to Fisherman's Wharf. And I took a little bike ride. I don't eat down there no more because I just don't eat down there no more. But I went into a store that sells nautical items, nautical artifacts in San Francisco's Fisherman Wharf. You know, mixed in with the tourist dreck, the T-shirts. The guy is actually a store that sells real fisherman stuff. But he has artifacts, like nautical artifacts, steering wheels and ship models. So I like to poke around in there. I hadn't been in there in a year. The guy's a big Sicilian guy. He remembered me, of course, but I hadn't been in there any. I go in, so I'm touching this item, that. How much is this? How much is that? I see a pair of shoes, like size 16 shoes. Each shoe weighs 50 pounds, and it's next to a diving helmet. They're diving shoes. They're weighted. So I pick one up, and I struggle it over to the counter, and I say, how much did these Sicilian swimming shoes cost? He broke out in a big laugh. He got a kick out of that one. But I felt bad, so I bought a compass, a $20 compass. I could have bought it in probably a Target store for a buck. But, you know, I don't like to just go look around in a store and just be a deadbeat. You know, I told you, you go in a store, you buy something. But I thought the Sicilian swimming shoe thing was funny. So now I have Teddy, Tasha, and Toby. And that was it. And we stopped at a Thai restaurant that had an outdoor table and a parking lot. See, that's the problem with dogs. Once you have dogs, you no longer eat like a human being inside a restaurant with tablecloths. Now every decision is made upon who has an outdoor table that will let you bring dogs to the outside. So you're limited already. You're already eating in a marginal situation. But you know what? It's a trade-off. I'd rather see a dog next to me and a table that's a little shaky on a terrace, right? And it was dark already, than sit and listen to liberals inside discussing what a great man Obama is, you know, about how evil Nixon was. You know what I'm saying? So I'm eating. The dogs get nothing. What are you going to order a dog in a Thai restaurant? But I even figured that out by now. Wherever I go, you got to order something for a dog. So I said, can I order a side order of boiled chicken, no spices? Sure, for the dog. They probably charged me $8. I was afraid to look. But to tell you the truth, Toby and Teddy really liked that chicken. So that's my life today. Thank God it's not diver shoes. It's three dogs and a Cadillac. And now on that note, play some There's a Moon Out Tonight, and I'll get back to regular programming on the Savage Nation. I can't wait to play with Toby tonight.
Motor cooled down, the heat went down, and that's when I heard that highway sound. Cadillac setting like a ton of lead, 110 a half a mile ahead. Cadillac looking like it's setting still, and I caught Maybelline at the top of the hill. Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline.
It is Chuck Berry. When America was great, when the chrome was thick and the women were straight. Yeah. Are we ever going to get this country back? Are we ever going to have an American in the White House? Are we ever going to have a government we can trust?